Alan Butler, co-author with Janet Walter of the book American Nation of the Goddess. We're talking about the Venus families and the founding of the United States. We're getting into a little mysteries here, and we'll come back in a moment and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to the hour of your phone calls. Alan Butler with us. Alan, when Janet Walter, your co-author, was on with me prior to, I asked her if the founders were evil at all, and she said absolutely not. Do you concur with that?
Yes, I do. We found nothing in our evidence base whatsoever to indicate that these people were trying to do anything other than something wonderful.
They wanted out of England. They wanted change, didn't they?
Absolutely. And not just England. They wanted out of Western Europe generally, because everywhere over here was run by either emperors or kings. And what they wanted most of all was an equitable society where people were free.
Now, some of the families that created the United States, of course, still exist today, don't they?
Well, yes, absolutely. But it's very difficult to know for sure whether some of the big business families of the United States, which did so much ostensibly towards building the country, were actually Venus members themselves, or whether they had been utilized by people behind the scenes. The one thing that we know for sure about the Venus families is that they don't advertise their presence.
No.
There are times when you can see that they are definitely there, and sometimes in very high places. Just as one example, President Franklin D. Roosevelt was almost certainly a Venus family member and came from a powerful, rich, and influential family. But, of course, he never advertised the fact.
Why does everything seem to be shrouded in mystery, secrecy, symbolism?
I think the main reason for this goes back historically. There was a time when the Venus families were at work in Western Europe, particularly from the 12th century onwards, when everything was being run by the Catholic Church. In the end, the Catholic Church did try to destroy the Venus families, particularly via the Knights Templar. So right from the start, these people had a vested interest in keeping themselves to themselves and not letting individuals know who they actually were. And it was a form of self-protection, really. There are reasons why they would want to do the same thing today, because there are many pressure groups in the world that would not like what the Venus family stand for. So I think the symbolism and the secrecy have really been a form of self-protection.
Were they particularly spiritual, Alan?
Yes, absolutely. But with a proviso. We can see from the documents left by the founding fathers that they were not committed towards a particular religion as far as the state was concerned. On the contrary, the very fundamental fabric of the Constitution of the United States makes it very plain that anybody there can believe what they want to believe, but that those beliefs must not be allowed to interfere with the running of the state. So whilst most Venus, if not all Venus family members, tend to have a very strong slant towards the female aspect of God, they don't wear that on their sleeves, and they certainly don't evangelize about it.
How are they able to put together a constitution that seems even to this day to be so perfect?
They spent an awful lot of time looking for it. They cherry-picked other documents. They took the best from everything that they could find. But because they'd lived for so long below the surface of civilization in Western Europe, and because their ideals were the way they were, they had a long, long time to think about these things. They saw what they didn't like in the old world, and so they built what they did like and what they thought was right in the new world. The Constitution was not something that just sprang out of a few weeks' conversation in Philadelphia. It had been on the drawing boards for centuries.
How close does our Constitution echo the Magna Carta of 1215?
I think there's no doubt whatsoever that there is an association. And as I said a moment ago, the Venus family members and the founding fathers who put the Constitution together were very much aware of documents like the Magna Carta. The difference was that Magna Carta, being so far back in time, was really more to do with the aristocracy and high-ranking people than to do with ordinary people. So the Constitution of the United States is like the Magna Carta, but it's more universal.
Within that, that quest for spirituality and for fairness and everything else, why hide things with this symbolism? Why, I mean, were they afraid of people?
They were certainly afraid of specific institutions. When they were still in Western Europe, they were afraid of certain kings and certain emperors. But their main problem was that they would come up against the established church. Historically speaking, the Catholic Church was very powerful and also very jealous. It didn't like anybody believing anything which was not its own belief. So very early on, the Venus family learned how to hide within institutions like the Catholic Church. There are times when, for short periods of time, they virtually ran it. There were times when they had popes who belonged to the Venus families. But in the main, they had to stay below the surface. If you uttered any words which opposed Catholic doctrine, you were likely to be burned.
All right, let's go and take some calls here for you. For the time remaining, we go to Tallahassee, Florida. Our friend Moses is with us. Moses, welcome back.
Good morning, George.
Hi.
Good morning, Alan.
Morning, Moses. Nice to hear you.
Yes, I'm really enjoying the show. And, George, you asked Alan a part of my question about the artifacts of Egypt. Originally called ancient Kemet, the Egyptian called it Egypt, meaning land of the burnt black faces. Okay, so you mentioned part of the question, but I found some information at the site in Mesoamerica called El Azuzul at San Lorenzo. It shows Olmecs that has an Egyptian headdress, and they are prostrating in front of a jaguar. That's the cat up there.
As opposed to the car, right?
Well, as opposed to the Egyptian, I mean, the commanders called the Egyptian had the lion on the sphinx. So the cat of the Mesoamerica is the black panther or the cougar. So again, these Olmecs who has the headdress of the Egyptian, it don't have a serpent on the third eye. It has like a sun, a solar disc ball at the third eye location. Do you have any information on that, Brother Allen? I'll take your answer off the air, please.
I think that there are several things we can be absolutely certain about. Obviously, it would have been very difficult for the Mesoamerican people to worship or to utilize the lion, since the animal did not exist in that part of the world. The jaguar was there and probably served the same ritual function as the lion would in Egypt. I have no doubt whatsoever that the Egyptians did travel quite extensively and that they probably were in Mesoamerica. We noticed that a lot of the large Olmec faces have African features, and there were African pharaohs in Egypt. The Egyptians themselves didn't seem to differentiate in racial terms. But it could well be that the jaguar had a particular association with the Egyptians that had traveled to that region, and included amongst those would have been Africans, black Africans.
You know, Alan, when you were doing the research with Janet, did you come across anything that was profound, that baffled you?
Oh, frequently, and still does. But I think the best explanation for that is it only baffles us because at that moment in time, we don't know. We see the symbolism on paper, but also on the landscape in the cities of the United States. We see that symbolism as being like looking at an onion. which has many skins. So on the surface, we see one thing. When a skin is removed, we see something else. And almost on a daily basis, the scales fall from our eyes and we see something that we probably should have seen all along. But it takes time to understand how these people think and how they've acted. But I am mystified, I am perplexed, almost on a daily basis. But if we keep looking, we always find the answers.
Indeed we do. Let's go next to Julie in Idaho. Good morning, Julie.
Well, good morning to you. I did want, maybe you could pass a message on to Scott Walder's wife. I guess about 2 years ago, I sent an Egyptian book that really made reading the hieroglyphs easy. I sent it back to New York when I saw the series of, the one that they showed.
Yeah.
And I would like to get a reply from them. I'm sure that they have my phone number. But anyway, these hieroglyphs, it goes clear on back to the dinosaur age. And the way the reading of that time is, and I'll just say the funny thing that happened, this is over 40 years of work or more. Anyway, I was told they were going to take me and show me something. So anyway, during the night, somehow, I was taken somewhere. I was shown three different things, and one was three great big stone lions in the face of slabs of stone, the paws, slabs of stone crawling out of the earth, and that's the records. And then somehow, and this is such deep work, I was, it's almost like I learned to write as a scribe somewhere and still be here. And I mean, it was so deep, I was struggling to stay, you know, here. But it seems like all through that time, it was through many, many civilizations, through the Constitution, our fathers of the Constitution, through all of that. And I was trying to do the writings or the drawings of the peoples and the different things. So there's many, but it's like a past, present, future type of thing where I even have what I think is star maps. Someday I'll get with somebody that can look at that and see if they are.
That'd be cool. I'd like to see that.
I don't want people bugging me. I've had too many try to pester me. When I did, and I'm not interested in any of that kind. I mean, I'm interested in getting with somebody that could work with me, and I could show them what I have. There's been some things that are not very good. But boy, whatever this is, it was moving fast. I would just get with a civilization. I'd learn about it, and all of a sudden I'm whisked into another.
Well, let me ask Alan this. When you went looking for, you know, artifacts and unraveling mysteries, how do you start that?
I think it's just, if you're the kind of person who has an interest in history, as I have since I was a child, and if you are naturally curious, and especially if you travel, you come across certain things that are really difficult to explain. Just as one example, there's a place in Lebanon called Baalbek.
Yes.
And at Baalbek there is an ancient temple. Nobody knows how ancient it is. And some of the stones that form this temple are absolutely massive. And they were quarried in one piece. Now, it's very difficult to understand, even using modern technology, how those stones could have been quarried in one piece without breaking, and how they could have been transported a mile and a half to the site where they sit now. Now, this is not specifically our topic for tonight, but it's just one example. When you look at that, you are forced to say to yourself, this is not magic. There must be an explanation. And that's what I spent my life looking for, the evidence that stands behind these things.
And, Alan, this work that you've done, does it tie in at all to anything spiritual or religious, like the Ark of the Covenant or anything like that?
There is a strong evidence that these people we were talking about before, the Knights Templar, they had a very big presence for probably half a century in the Holy Land, and especially in Jerusalem. And there is rumors and legends, particularly within Freemasonry, that the Knights Templar found certain objects under the temple in Jerusalem, which by that time, of course, had been ruined for 1,000 years, and that those objects, which may include the Ark of the Covenant, were subsequently brought to France, and we think we can track those objects from France ultimately to the United States. And this was all part of building what the Venus families would have called the New Jerusalem. And there could be caches of these treasures in various places in the United States. They may initially have been taken out west, but we think, Janet and I think, that at least some of them now stand in a chamber below the center of a park just south of the White House in Washington, D.C., which is called the Ellipse. We've got all sorts of mathematical and geometrical evidence showing that this structure must be there below the ground, and we also have historical data that says it must be. So it's quite likely that some of those objects are actually now in the United States.
We'll go next to Brenda in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Hey, Brenda, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
Well, I have a question. When you're looking at Washington, D.C. and the White House, it looks like the planogram is in the shape of a pentagram. And I was wondering, who were the planners and what is the story behind this? And my other question is, for the ancestors of the Venus family, do they know who they are? And if they have plans for the society and the politics for them today.
All right, let's answer the ancestors question first. Go ahead, Ellen.
Okay, now I think that there's no doubt whatsoever that at least some, in fact probably most, of those who are from Venus families know exactly who they are and know exactly what their background is. We have evidence, not least of all, through things that were written down in Victorian times, even in novels, which seems to indicate that this group of people did exist and they knew who they were. When we call these people the Venus families, I think we have to be a little bit careful because they may not always be blood-tied families. We think that it's possible that people can be brought into the Venus families, and they would be brought in because of their beliefs, because of their influence and their power and so forth. They may then pass on that down their own family lines. But I don't think there's any doubt that those people who are of the Venus family know that they are.
And back to the White House, of course, they started construction in 1792. It was torched by the British in 1814.
Yes, I'm sorry about that, George.
That's okay. And the architect, James Hoban, was one of the lead architects that put the reconstruction of the house together. It's amazing how old that is, but he was the genius behind the White House. Well, we're going to come back with final questions for our special guest, Alan Butler, in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, author of the book, American Nation of the Goddess, co-author, of course, with Janet Walter. And on our next Coast to Coast program, by the way, Christian Von Lehr joins us on some psychic worlds and Chase Klotsky on UFOs, so it's all paranormal tomorrow. And we're back with our final segment with Alan Butler, co-author of the book with Janet Walter on American Nation of the Goddess. Where do you get your book, Alan?
The book can be purchased from Amazon, from your local bookshop. There are other bookshops that advertise on the net where you can get it. And also, if you go to our website, you will find a link which will take you to the purchase of the book.
How many families do you think consisted of this grouping?
I have to tell you that of all the questions you asked me this evening, this is the one that I find most difficult to answer. Obviously, there is a reasonably high percentage because the aims and objectives of the Venus families have been carried out all across the United States. I think there are probably quite a few thousand people involved, but because they are and always have been so secretive, it's impossible to gauge the actual numbers.
But they're out there. Is it a lot, would you say?
Many thousands, I think.
Yeah, that's a lot. I think that's a lot. How many today do you think are extremely influential or successful families?
They must still be there. I mean, we see them particularly in the creation, the physical creation of Washington, D.C., New York, and other cities in the United States. But since these structures are still being created, and some of them are very big, like, for example, the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., was only completed, 20 years ago. And because these big infrastructures are still being created, we know that there are some influential people there. But generally speaking, we think that the Venus families would settle themselves into positions where they had influence which wasn't probably up front. There have been, as I've said, Venus family member presidents, but mostly they seem to stick to planning organizations and committees. So they're the shakers and movers behind the scenes.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. Dalton, Georgia, we go. First time caller. It's Witt's turn. Witt, thank you for calling, sir.
Oh, hi, George. How are you?
Good, Witt. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I've been listening since the 1990s.
Well, thank you.
You know, I love the shows that you do that you're maybe a little more grounded.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I have, my comment was, is that North America presented a great resource to Europe, and one of those resources was pine tar, which kept the British Navy afloat, and North America had an incredible resource with that. And I guess my comment is that, you know, follow the money. It doesn't have to involve some kind of a cult or a
conspiracy or anything like that.
Or it doesn't, because North America had so much potential, and you know, the pine trees in America and the mineral resources and everything was something that Great Britain needed, which is why they put up such a struggle. But every country, you know, that was a major power in Europe was after North America. And it wasn't because of some kind of Venus thing or anything else. It was just a follow-the-money situation. And that's my...
All right, let's get Alan's take on that. Thanks a lot, Witt. Appreciate that. Follow the money, Alan. What do you think?
Yes, I think there's a great deal of truth in that statement, and there's no doubt whatsoever that the British Empire was tremendously upset to lose North America, and its upset had very little to do with its consideration for the colonists, but rather what it was losing in economic terms. And it's true that the French were there, the Spanish were there, everybody was there because, as Witt says, the resources were tremendous. But what we see with the Venus families and what they did was they wanted to not alienate themselves, but they wanted to divorce themselves from the influence that was coming from other countries. And it's in that we see their presence. They were the ones through the founding fathers who created the Constitution, who wanted a free United States. And once they'd made up their mind to that, they were going to get it. They knew they were reasonably isolated. They knew that no other country could launch the sort of invasion of the United States that would work over such a large distance. They just had to stick out, and the plans had begun in a long time. So on the one hand, I agree absolutely with Witt, but I also say that the fact that these powers in Western Europe lost control of the United States tells its own tale as well.
Was someone like Benjamin Franklin part of the Venus families? I mean, he was born in the United States.
Yes, without a doubt. And, of course, he was one of the Venus family members who had great influence back in the old world as well, both in Britain and especially in France. France was very important to the United States when it was first seeking independence. So people like Franklin, and then later Thomas Jefferson, who spent a long time in France, were really important to the building of the plans.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Patrick in Miami. Welcome to the show. Patrick, go ahead, sir.
Hey, guys. glad you mentioned Jefferson. Very important. And I agree with you. I mean, you know, who wrote the Constitution? Jefferson did. You know, while George Washington was fighting off the Brits, his wife was running a full institution of society and making things work. And I agree with you though. There's, you know, you can argue that, I would say that's Franklin, you know, Jefferson and Washington, but you know, and you can't also dismiss Madison, you know, and they're all in that little area. But I mean, they are very special people. I would like your input in terms of, because I think it was really Jefferson that created this whole thing, and you have to remember he was the first ambassador. Okay, he went to France. Okay, so anyways, I like your thoughts.
Well, that I think they were all part of the group, weren't they, Ellen?
Yes, they were. But your caller is absolutely correct in putting the finger on Thomas Jefferson, who seems probably to have been the most important of all because he had a good historical and political background. He knew what he was talking about. He was a fantastic writer. So it was good to have him in the right place at the right time. He was a shaker and mover also as far as inside free America was concerned. He wanted to develop new strategies, new measuring systems for the United States. And he saw the importance of farming in the United States in building a country there. So probably alongside George Washington, the most important.
These were pioneers. They were patriots. They were bright individuals who cared about people.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And if we look at the Constitution, and if we look particularly at the passages of writing that appear inside the Jefferson Memorial, for example, we see the way their minds were working. They were absolutely committed to personal freedom and to building something which had never existed in the world before. The bravest attempt that has ever been made in the world to build something new.
I asked Janet earlier, Alan, if those founders would be turning over in their graves right now, and she said yes.
I think to a certain extent that's true. The only way I would disagree with Janet would be to say that the one thing we know about the Venus families and the way that they have carried themselves across so many centuries is that they are very patient people. They know there is going to be reversals. They know there will be difficulties. And perhaps personally, they would be shocked at the way the world is going now, but maybe not as much as we think. They're patient.
We go now to Tom, truck driving in Texas. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Good morning, George and Alan.
Good morning.
I'm proud to talk to both of you.
Thank you.
I was wondering why it is with Alan and his colleagues, when they do the research in the background and they come up with hard evidence, why they experience such a pushback on their findings of this thing. What possibly other than, you know, like Scott says, you know, the history we've been taught in the books is wrong. I'd kind of like to hear what Alan's take on that is.
Yeah, that's really good, Tom, a really good question. I think it's all to do with power broking. When somebody starts an organization, be it a political one or a religious one or almost anything, then gradually, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And people, when they get into an institution, even if it's a scientific one, for example, they want to be the head of that. They want to control the people below them. And what has set the Venus families apart is that they don't function in that way. They slowly and steadily work their way forward. They maintain a set of beliefs that they've maintained for centuries. On the way, they are always going to encounter people from other organizations that form pressure groups. I mean, it's so common in religion and has been throughout history that You must believe what I tell you to believe, and if you believe anything different, then you are damned. That's not the way the Venus families work. But that's a great question, Tom, and we get pushed back all the time from all sorts of different directions, political and especially religious. But like the Venus families, we just keep trucking on like you are, Tom.
Where does your research take you, Alan? What's next?
We want to broaden our evidence base as far as the United States is concerned. We've looked very closely at Washington, D.C. We've looked very closely at New York. We particularly want to turn our attention towards other cities like Chicago and the other bigger and important cities in the United States, because we know we're going to find evidence there.
Let's take a couple more quick calls. Mike in West Palm Beach, California, I believe. Is that where you are, Michael?
Yeah, how you doing?
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead, Mike.
I want an opinion of two maps. The Vineland map, dated 1453, showing the east coast of Canada, and the Perry Reese map, which is supposedly a lost map of Columbus. I'd like the opinion of the guests.
Yeah, there are many, many maps from history and even from prehistory which seem to defy all logic in terms of the knowledge the people at that time should have had. But I think this bears out what Janet and I and Scott as well, especially Scott, believe, that the people travelled to the New World, to the United States, as it is now, on many, many occasions, and probably across the best part of 5,000 years. Now, academia does not like maps like the Perry Reese map because they go against orthodox belief, and the academics really don't like that. But when you are faced with irrefutable evidence, which is known to have come from a time before these things were known, then you can only interpret it in one way.
Well, and that is the only way you could interpret it. There's no question about that.
No, absolutely.
Do you think the Brits were truly upset when they lost the Revolutionary War?
Yes, I think they were. But Janet and I were talking about this ourselves a couple of days ago. Really, the problem lay with the king, the British king, and also his advisors, who were not very wise. The vast majority of influential and intellectual people in Great Britain at that time wanted to protect the colonies in the United States and knew what would happen if they pushed too hard. Having said that, I am equally convinced that there was a group of people already in the United States who would have settled for nothing less than full independence. So I think there's a bit of pushing on going on from both directions, but really, Britain lost America when it did because of its own stupidity.
Yeah, absolutely. And times have changed ever since, haven't they, Alan?
Yes, thank goodness.
Alan, thanks a lot. You take care. You keep in touch with us, okay?
It's been absolutely great. Thank you so much, George.
You've got it. Yeah, he was last on with me 11 years ago. 11 years ago. Wow. Long, long time. Great program for you tomorrow. It's all paranormal tomorrow night. And then we'll be dabbling with some unusual things on Friday night, and especially those special open lines for you here on Coast to Coast AM. And by the way, happy birthday again to our senior producer, Tom Danheiser. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, the birthday boy, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.